Hello, it's Tuesday, April the 6th. I'm Andrew Pearce, and this is The Andrew Pearce Show, and it's coming from the Daily Mail newsroom. Food myths. You heard of some of them? Stay tuned. We're going to give you quite a few more. Also, are we really geared for a third wave of the wretched coronavirus? International travel. I thought it was all back on May the 17th, but now we're not so sure. And are you really going to take up the government's invitation to do not one, but two rapid flow COVID tests at home? It involves sticking what looks like a knitting needle up your nose. Boris Johnson's multi-billion pound plan, we don't know how much it's going to cost actually, to invite everyone in England to take two free rapid flow COVID tests a week could lead to a public health disaster, according to one former NHS consultant. The Prime Minister, however, believes the scheme will stop outbreaks in their tracks. But Dr. John Lee, former Professor of Pathology at Hull York Medical School and a recently retired NHS consultant, has written a powerful piece in the Mail warning it could lead to fear-mongering and hundreds of thousands of people being forced to self-isolate needlessly. He joins me now. The point about this is, Dr. Lee, apart from the fact they're unpleasant, and I'm not sure people are very particularly well qualified to administer these tests themselves, they are not very accurate, are they?
Yes, well, they can be accurate if they're done properly. But the point is that they're not. No test is 100% accurate. So there's always a risk with a test that you know, that the result you get isn't the correct result. And in this case, the result we're mainly worried about is that you do the test, you haven't got the disease, you haven't got the virus on you, and yet the test says you're positive. And although that should only happen on a small proportion of cases, when you do millions of tests, that turns into a big number of people affected by a wrong test.
Well, I was going to say, because I was looking at your figures, they're fascinating, aren't they? Even people who are advocating this scheme of us all have doing these tests twice a week say 0.1% of these lateral flow tests are thought to produce a false positive result. Now, if you consider how many people the government wants to have these tests, that could lead, I think by your calculations, to 120,000 people every week being wrongly told they've got the virus. They then have to isolate. They don't go to work. That damages the economy and it causes all sorts of other problems.
Yes, indeed. Well, I mean, it does seem that we're more or less in a stage now, doesn't it, of another day dawns and another dose of confusion and incoherence from the government on COVID. I really don't think they know what they're doing. The trouble with this is the maths is very simple. 0.1% for false positives means 1 in 1,000 people. That means if you test a million people, you have 1,000 people that would appear to have a false positive test. And I have to say that 0.1% figure, I think it's very, very, very generous to the test, because when you have people doing these tests in their own homes and doing them on a mass basis, there's a lot more room for error than when you're doing these tests in accredited laboratories. So really 0.1% is a very, very generous figure. So if you test 60 million people at 0.1%, that's 60,000 false positives per test. And if you do that twice a week, that's 120,000 people per week.
It's eye-watering.
He'll be given the wrong answer. So, and the point is, it necessary? Because obviously the whole roadmap out of lockdown from the government was predicated on the vaccines being a success. And actually, that's one thing that has gone well in this country. We have got the vaccines rolled out very well. We have protected the most vulnerable groups. And it turns out the vaccine is very, very effective after just one dose. So the fact is, we should be cheering from the rooftops, not introducing further complications and nonsense.
The other thing about these tests, they're not easy and they're not pleasant because it's a bit like sticking a knitting needle into the back of your nostril, both nostrils, or you do a swab of your throat. Now, I don't think necessarily, I know they've been doing these at schools and people might say, man up, you'll get used to it. But that will add to the scope, surely, Dr. Lee, for more errors in the way people administer the tests on themselves.
Well, I think so. I mean, with anything, there's a risk and a benefit to doing these things. And, you know, one of the things that's been conspicuously absent during the whole of the last year is proper risk-benefit analysis of what the government's been doing and telling us to do. And, I mean, if I could just say a word about asymptomatic cases, a lot of the reason why we're being encouraged to do this is because people have this fixed idea that you can have COVID and yet not have any symptoms at all, but still be a risk to other vulnerable people and then catching the disease and becoming very ill with it. And this has been really the whole basis for lockdowns than for most of the socially intrusive measures that have been adopted. And yet the scientific evidence for asymptomatic spread is minimal. But now that we've had the vaccination, by far the largest group of people who are coming back as a positive test when they're asymptomatic are people who are in fact immune to the virus. Because if you think about it, if you're exposed to the virus and a few viruses get into your body, they start multiplying in a few of your cells, your immune system notices it, and because you're immune, it stamps on them. But the fact is that can still show up as a positive test because PCR multiplies it by, you know, a factor of 2 to the 30 or 2 to the 25, which is an enormous number. So what we're really doing now with a lot of the PCR testing anyway is actually detecting people who are immune from the virus, and yet that is now going to drive a further, you know, wave of panic and apparent, you know, third wave or fourth wave or whatever it is, when in fact the epidemic is largely over.
It's not for you, of course, to get in the mindset of our Prime Minister, but I do wonder if this Prime Minister, bruised, wounded, he had COVID himself, there is legitimate criticism, some would argue, for how quickly or slowly we went into lockdown. It's because of the fact we have still got the highest death rate in Europe. Do you think that's why he is now being, perhaps you could argue, overcautious in wheeling out, for instance, these rapid flow tests for everybody to encourage everybody to have them at home, COVID passports, and we're not really quite sure how practically they're going to work and if there's going to be any element of compunction in them. Is this a Prime Minister burnt the first time, doesn't want to get burnt again?
Well, you get the suspicion there's an element of that, and you also get the suspicion that it's, you know, that they really don't know what they're dealing with. I think it's also partly the dysfunctional way in which government advice has been set up. They are taking their advice from a narrow range of people on SAGE, and unfortunately the way they do that is by asking SAGE to tell them about worst case scenarios. But the thing is, we never plan our lives on the basis of worst case scenarios. I mean, if we did that, we wouldn't drive, we wouldn't fly, we wouldn't eat, you know. I mean, the worst case scenario is always bad. So I think worst case scenario planning is a dysfunctional way to approach something like COVID. I think Boris Johnson obviously had a nasty personal experience with it. But then remember, he had that personal experience right when panic was high and knowledge was low, and quite possibly had an experience that was much worse than it needed to be because people were so panicked about the idea that people were, remember how many ventilators were being used then, and they've completely pretty much disappeared now from the treatment. So I think it's a mixture of a whole bunch of things. But what I really do think is that they are taking worst case scenario planning from a narrow group of people who are very vested in this narrative because they've been peddling this narrative all the way along. And yet there are many, many sensible, thoughtful, educated people, I count myself one of those, who have severe problems with with what we have been doing. And really right now we should be congratulating ourselves on a really successful vaccine rollout. And the fact is, the overall deaths from all causes now are below the five-year average. And actually, I should say that the number that you say, this 126,000 number that people keep on talking about in terms of the COVID deaths, that's a highly contentious figure because of all the ways in which COVID has been tested for and recorded. So the actual number of people who've died as a direct result of COVID is much, much lower than that figure. But again, that really isn't something that's debated much in public.
Fascinating, and always fascinating to talk to you. That's Dr. John Lee, who's written a very powerful piece in the paper today about why this perverse plan, he thinks, will spark even more fear-mongering over COVID. Thanks for joining us. Now, why don't you visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to The Andrew Pearce Show for free and in full, along with our podcast and video series too. Remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. So in his much-vaunted Downing Street briefing, which, to be honest, didn't reveal much new to me, the Prime Minister was asked about foreign travel. Could it begin again on May the 17th? And I don't think he held up much cheer at all, even though the Sunday papers had clearly been briefed that foreign travel was likely to restart again on May the 17th, albeit through the much-vaunted traffic light system, green, amber or red, depending on which country you go to. The travel industry has predictably reacted with anger because the Prime Minister has refused to rule out extending the international travel ban into the summer. I'm joined now by the Daily Mail's travel editor, Mark Palmer. Mark, I bet your phone has been red hot with leading figures in the travel industry. It must be pulling their hair out.
It's been steaming, Andrew. Smoke has been coming out of the telephone. I think that the main thing, as you touched on, that there was a lot of talk about the traffic light system. In fact, the Prime Minister never mentioned the traffic light system at all. It was discussed and papers, as you said, were briefed about it. But there was no detail about that whatsoever. And then what has really irked the travel industry, and particularly the Association of Independent Tour Operators, AITO, they were absolutely despairing, because tucked away on page 5 of the short document that was handed out in paragraph 22 was the damning statement that said, for the moment, the government advises people not to book summer holidays abroad until the picture is clearer. And that has just thrown a complete spanner in the works, because we are now told to wait until perhaps later this week, possibly next Monday, when the global task force reports back to the Prime Minister. We might possibly be a bit clearer then. But honestly, people are beginning to despair and to think that we're never going to be given a clear roadmap out of this crisis when it comes to foreign travel.
And I would have thought, whether you're running a hotel or a resort or an airline, Mark, you need more than 2 days' notice to get up and running, to prepare and to cater for tens of thousands of tourists.
You're absolutely right, Andrew. You can see all over the country now in the last 2 weeks that shops have been gearing up and cleaning up their premises and getting stock ready and everything else. Well, it takes an awful lot longer for an airline, for example, to get planes in the right place, to get staff who know what they're doing. They don't know yet what the whole rule is going to be about testing. We don't know whether it's going to be a PCR test or whether the lateral flow test is going to suffice. There are so many questions up in the air. And it's really time that the government just showed that they have some sort of authority on this, and rather than just saying, well, we'll wait and see. The wait and see policy is not good enough anymore.
And there'll be some people, I just think about when I was growing up as a child, my father worked for a factory, Mark. It was the same 2 weeks summer holiday every year, the same dates. The whole town would be on holiday that 2 weeks. So they'd have to book and make plans. So there'll be all sorts of families listening to this who want to book and are probably now going to probably see if they can get something at home, a staycation. Good luck with that, because they just can't risk waiting any longer for the Prime Minister to stop dithering over foreign travel.
Absolutely. And of course, a lot of people have booked, and TUI, which is the biggest tour operator in the world, they've taken a huge number of bookings based on the idea that from May the 17th, we're going to be able to travel. I suspect that, again, they're going to have to be refunding people or giving people a voucher and hoping that people will push it forward to July or August. But Andrew, I think we need to remind ourselves that the annual holiday, as you said, is so important to people. Mm. It's the chance for them to take their foot off the pedal, to get their life in some sort of balance again, to have some fun. And I think more so, particularly now, given that we've been 12 months in the doldrums and haven't been able to go out at all.
And we're all desperate for some sunshine. If the one year I would have really liked to have gone and lazed on a Greek island is this year, Mark, because I could think, I don't have to worry, no stress, no hassle, the weather's going to be great, but I can't bear all this uncertainty, so I'm not bothering with a holiday abroad.
No, I think you're right. And I mean, over this Easter weekend, normally that would be a time where people would go away. And it was almost sort of sad in a way, seeing people on Saturday, certainly in the south here, we had some sunshine, and the people sort of sticking their heads out of the window and just sort of feeling a bit of sun on their cheeks. Mm. And my goodness, that longing to be in clement weather is so strong at the moment.
I'm just popping lots of vitamin D pills, Mark. They're very cheap in Boots. Well,
and you're probably actually putting on some fake tan, aren't you, Andrew?
Not yet, but maybe I will. That's Mark Palmer, our August travel editor. Thanks for joining us. If you enjoy The Andrew Pearce Show, and we hope you do, why don't you subscribe to us, leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Google or Spotify. And if you want to get in touch, tweet us at MailPlus or me at ToryBoyPearce. So Britain is highly likely to suffer a third wave of COVID infections and deaths once the lockdown restrictions are lifted in June, government scientists have warned. The Scientific Advisory Group for Emergencies, you know it better as SAGE, said that hospital admissions could once again hit the level seen in the first wave, according to some of the more pessimistic projections and modelling. I'm joined now by Dr. Gabriel Scally. He's President of Epidemiology and Public Health at the Royal Society of Medicine, and he's a member of the independent SAGE group. Dr. Scally, welcome back to this podcast. some people think they're all just being too gloomy and too pessimistic, the people doing the modelling for Sage. Do you share that view, or are they being just brutally realistic?
I think it's a realistic view. I'm tremendously optimistic. I think vaccination is fantastic and a great success, a fantastic rollout. But I do worry about taking the foot off the brake too early and risking some of the progress we've made. Now, the reason why is we've managed to protect the people at highest risk and the most vulnerable. But there are a lot of other people who may not be at high risk, but might have moderate risk factors or low risk factors, but still at risk. And if we let the virus now spread wildly because we think we've protected everyone, well, there are a lot of those people, and a lot of them will get infected, and unfortunately, quite a number of them will get ill. So it is quite easy to see how the models would lead you to believe that if we relax too much, then the hospitals will fill up again. I think that is what might happen. So the best thing to do would be to avoid that.
So how do we avoid that? Because the Prime Minister made absolutely clear the route map for opening up is on course for the partial opening on April the 12th. Then there'll be more on May the 17th. Obviously, they'll review again if we carry on with the review with the lifting of restrictions by June the 21st. But by the end of June to sort of July, we could be much more back to some form of normality, although I think social distancing will continue, and I suspect they will require us to carry on wearing masks.
Well, some of that, I think, will have to carry on. Israel is a good example of a country that's done it well. They've got nearly everyone vaccinated, at least in not in the occupied territories and in Palestinian areas, but much of the population vaccinated, but they still have mask-wearing policies outdoors and indoors, and they're only now thinking about relaxing them. So, and they've done really well. So look at people who've done it well. I think the issues are really twofold. If we go back to doing things normally, well, we can't do that because we know COVID is still going to be around, and there are variants around, and some of them may dodge the vaccine and put us back enormously. So how can we go forward then? Well, we can do it safely, and we can do some of the things that haven't received enough attention. We know, for example, that COVID doesn't transmit very well out of doors, so we can do more things out of doors that we would normally do inside. We can ventilate places better. Both schools, which should by now have their ventilation improved dramatically, I don't think that's happened. Workplaces, according to the law, employers must make sure that there's an adequate supply of fresh air in enclosed areas of workplaces. I don't think that's happening. We really need to make these places safe for people. That's how we can get back to work.
What of the contention over the effectiveness of the vaccines? Because in some of the pages that were pulled out of the government yesterday, Dr. Scally, you'll have read them and understand it much better than me, of course, but the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine had a much more pessimistic view of the efficacy of AstraZeneca, where, by comparison to Warwick University and Imperial College London, they rated the vaccine more highly. They both can't be right. Maybe it's in the middle somewhere. But if the London School of Hygiene is wrong and the AstraZeneca vaccine is more effective, then perhaps there is too much gloom and doom around.
Well, yes, but you can really only make those judgments in retrospect. And the safest thing to do is to play things safely and do things properly and slowly and find out as you're going along. I think all too often the models are voyeuristic, really. They sit back and see what's happening and then say, oh, this is what's going to happen from here on in. But that's too late because things have already started to go wrong by that time. So my view of the effectiveness of the vaccine is, in some respects, we're learning a lot more, and a lot of it's very positive, so that we know now for some of the vaccines that people who've been vaccinated do not transmit the disease. They don't get the symptoms and they don't get ill, but neither do they transmit the disease, and that's a major step forward. Yes, there are concerns, particularly about the effectiveness of the vaccines against variants, and that includes the AstraZeneca vaccine is one of the ones where there are variants that could potentially dodge it. But we need to, again, work out what the variants are that are coming. But the better way of dealing with it is to keep the variants out, and that's why the government's sort of managed quarantine, managed isolation processes on our ports and airports. Those are really, really important and really should be universal if we want to keep some of these dangerous variants at bay.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I was going to ask you just finally, there's been a lot of fuss because the Prime Minister, contrary to what we'd been led to believe in a lot of the papers, was going to outline the details of the traffic light system to enable foreign travel to restart in May. And now we don't know if that's going to happen at all. But the Times newspaper yesterday reported, and other papers have followed it, that between 8,000 to 20,000 people are coming into Britain every day, some of them on tourist visas. I find that astonishing in the first place because we're not allowed to go abroad unless it's for really urgent, pressing reasons. But do you worry, Dr. Scally, that 8,000, maybe 20,000 people coming in every day, they could be bringing in new variants of COVID and that could set back the entire public health programme?
I could indeed. And I'm very worried. And I've thought from the very beginning, but that's because I'm an old-fashioned public health doctor and I believe that things like quarantine and keeping the virus from getting to your shores is the best thing to do. Keep it out. And that's what we need to do. We need to get it down, of course, and that's what the social restrictions are about. We need to keep it down, and vaccination is really important in that, but so is a proper test and trace system. But keeping it out is really important. Some of these variants are very dangerous. And by the time one has popped up somewhere and made its way to these shores, it may be too late. So the best way, the only safe way of doing it, is to have quarantine arrangements that apply to everyone, managed isolation for everyone coming. There are ways it can be done. We can set a limit. The numbers that you mentioned of tourists coming is just ridiculous, yeah. I think. Just ridiculous. And you've got to remember they've mixed in airports on the way, mixed in airplanes.
Yeah.
Maybe come from holiday destinations themselves, where lots of different nationalities are all mixing in convivial atmospheres. And it's a sure guaranteed way to move the virus rapidly around the planet.
Indeed. That's Dr. Gabriel Scally, who's President of Epidemiology and Public Health at the Royal Society of Medicine. It's that time of the programme, one of my favourite parts of the programme. Ruth Sunderland's here. She's, of course, the business editor at the Daily Mail. Now, Ruth, it was ever thus the problem for women getting on in the workplace, but more so now because women, particularly at Aviva, worried they're going to miss out on promotions because they're feeling pressured to work from home and look after the kids while men go into the office and get ahead. Something to me sounds like it was ever thus.
Yes, I mean, wouldn't you just know it? I think with the advancement of women at work and the glass ceiling, it seems to be two steps forward and one and a half steps back all the time, doesn't it? So Aviva's drawn attention to what probably will be quite a big problem once we start getting back to normal, assuming that, of course, that ever happens. And what Aviva and quite a lot of companies would like to do is to keep some of the best elements of pandemic style working. So to enable employees to be a little bit more flexible about how they work, which, you know, overall probably might not be a bad thing. But what they're really looking out for is the risk that this might inadvertently cause harm to female workers' careers. Now, the reason they think this is that they think that if an employer offers flexible working with the opportunity to work from home, that women will feel obliged to take it up, even if they don't really want to, because it's seen as being more their responsibility to look after the kids, maybe even to care for elderly relatives or just look after the home. Meanwhile, guess what? Men are all flooding back into the office, networking, playing golf with each other, sucking up to the boss and getting promoted while women are, of course, stuck in the house. So I'm making a bit of an exaggeration here, but probably not much.
Yeah.
So Aviva, they're going to monitor this quite carefully when they bring in their return to the office, just to make sure that women are not losing out. And they make a very good point, which is that you shouldn't judge promotions and people's ability on just purely how long they're in the office and how visible they are. You should really judge it on results. And, you know, their theory is that women could be losing out because they're just not going to be quite that visible if they take advantage of working from home. So, you know, it's fascinating, really, isn't it? The unintended consequences that this could all have.
Another consequence of the pandemic, and as we know, we've talked about it before, women were always going to get the worst of the burden of the childcare, and now we see it's going to impact on their career prospects too.
I think that's right, and they're going to be looking very, very closely at the gender pay gap, because the suspicion is that people who are working from home might miss out on pay rises. So it's all very well. I think, you know, many people have enjoyed working from home, and that's great, but perhaps not so much when they realise that it could have an impact on their pay packet, and certainly could have an impact on their promotion prospects.
Absolutely. That's Ruth Sundin, who is, of course, business editor at the Daily Mail. Thanks for joining us. Dr. Joshua Woolrich has written a book which busts all sorts of dangerous and fascinating myths peddled around nutrition and how some diets are promoted as an alternative to medical treatment. In his book, Food Isn't Medicine, he breaks down a number of food myths, including that eggs can cause high cholesterol, sugar is addictive, and that meat can cause cancer. He joins me now. Dr. Joshua, you've been on a journey, haven't you? Because, of course, you were a hospital NHS doctor. You managed to tip the scale at 17 stones, so you obviously liked your food a bit too much. And then you became obsessed with the idea doctors shouldn't be overweight. You lost a lot of weight, and you're now an expert on nutrition.
Hello, Andrew. I guess you could put it that way. I think just some things to kind of clear up. I grew up a larger kid than most. I would have been classified as obese on the BMI scale when I was at university. But I'd internalized a lot of the stigma around my size that I'd experienced as a kid and growing up, and it led me to believe that you couldn't be a good doctor if you were fat, which is obviously something that just simply isn't true. But I believed it in myself, and it caused me a lot of harm, and it led me down a really problematic journey of using quite dangerous methods of trying to lose weight. So it's not something that I would or do encourage as that. But it did also lead me to kind of understanding a lot of where this bad thinking and where these fad diets and myths kind of come from. And it's given me a bit of an insight into weight stigma and around the complexities around weight and health. And there's a whole section in the book talking about that kind of stuff as well. I'm currently on a year out to study for a nutrition master's. I wouldn't necessarily call myself an expert, but I think I would call myself someone who likes to ask questions. And also likes to challenge the misinformation.
Well, your book does just that, Food Isn't Medicine, because it debunks a lot of the myths and it sets out your own philosophy. Interesting. The thing that caught my attention straight away, milk causes heart disease. Now, a lot of people say you've got to cut dairy out of your diet. And you're arguing that this perhaps is exaggerated. Why so? And is it right that some people do say as well that milk can be seen as a cure for breast cancer?
Yeah, so I think we get into slightly dangerous territory when it comes with different animal products. And I think the reason for that is because there is a very valid conversation to be had around the ethical responsibility, around animal production and all sorts of things along those lines. And so I think some of that conversation is very valid, but unfortunately, that's often not where the conversation ends. It often turns to things that just simply aren't true when it comes to trying to link things like dairy to health issues or health problems. And there are a lot of different myths going around. You mentioned the cancer one. I mean, dairy itself has been claimed to be a cause of breast cancer. Although that was something that was based on incredibly shoddy evidence and just hasn't shown any sort of reality or basis in reality moving forward. There's a lot of them in there that I cover, that we talk about, just trying to remove the fear around some of these kind of foods.
Yeah.
But also at the same time, clarifying that food itself isn't a cure for cancer either. As much as there are lots of myths around different foods causing cancer directly, some of them have more validity than others. I'll talk about some of that. But there's a lot around food being able to cure it. And that stuff is particularly dangerous, especially as there are quite a lot of the population who will end up ignoring kind of conventional and treatment that we know works, treatment that we know improves people's quality of life and length of life and survival with these kind of diseases. And they ignore them, and they go to things like juicing, or they go to things like changing their diet to a certain pattern that they've been told is going to work. And it's we see a lot of people in the hospital that are really coming to harm because of this kind of misinformation. And that's one of the things that really gets me and hurts.
Yeah. I tell you what else I found really fascinating. Sugar is as addictive as drugs. And you say it's compelling to read your brain lights up with sugar as it does with cocaine or heroin. But then you make the point, which made me laugh out loud. It's useful to note it's the same parts of the brain that are affected by playing with puppies. And nobody thinks playing with puppies is particularly toxic or bad for your health, unless, of course, they wee on you or bite you.
Yeah, well, I've got a 1 year old dog at home, and I can say that the biting was definitely difficult when she was much younger. But no, I mean it's a lovely little compelling sentence, right? It sounds great. And it's used in many supposed health documentaries on Netflix. I like to call them movies rather than documentaries because that's a much better representation of what they actually are. But it's not accurate. Like you can use little bits of facts to try and convince people of certain arguments. Sugar tastes great. The food that we have sugar in makes it taste brilliant. It makes it incredibly palatable. And yes, there are very valid reasons why we should be reducing the amount of sugar that we eat. And again, I talk about that as well, but not because we think it's addictive like hard drugs, because that's just simply not true. You can really enjoy food like that, but it's not going to have addictive tendencies. It's just not accurate.
Now, the last bit, I've got to ask you about this, and I know this will cause all sorts of controversy, and you know it's going to cause controversy, and I'm not saying that's why it's in the book, but are vegan diets healthier? So you'd never get me on a vegan diet in a million years, Doctor. I've got to tell you, I like my meat, I like my fish. But you're saying it may be healthier if you eat a lot of processed food, but not necessarily.
Well, look, I try and give as much nuance as possible because I don't want to come along and just blast certain things and refuse to kind of explain why people say certain things, because I think that doesn't help either. So look, a vegan diet can be really healthy, right? It's often a diet that is incredibly high in veg, in fiber, in, you know, unsaturated fat. It's brilliant. It can be really healthy for you. But it also could be a diet full of pizza and vegan burgers and chips and crisps. So it's not necessarily that you can just make a blanket statement that the vegan diet is healthier or a diet that isn't vegan is unhealthy. And we need to clarify what we mean when we talk about certain dietary patterns. Again, I make the point that being plant-based, so that doesn't mean you can't eat animal products, but eating more plants is incredibly good for you. And we should all be striving to try and do that within our own capabilities and privilege and affordability and all that kind of stuff. But making the claim that everybody should go vegan because it's healthier is not an accurate one. Again, there's a conversation around the ethical nature of animals in the diet. That's not what something that I've decided to cover in full depth because that's not my area of expertise. And that's not what I'm trying to argue against. I'm not just trying to get some sort of accuracy in here when we talk about these kind of things. A vegan diet can be healthy, but saying that it is automatically going to be healthier for you is a slippery slope into telling you that it's going to cure certain diseases. It means you're never going to get diabetes, all this kind of stuff that follows on from it, which isn't accurate and harms people.
Well, I think that's fascinating. I can't wait to read the book properly. That's Dr. Joshua Woolrich. His book is called Food Isn't Medicine. That's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, download the Mail Plus app every weekday at 5 p.m. You can listen to me all over again. I'm Andrew Pearce. This is The Andrew Pearce Show. I'll be back tomorrow. Have yourselves a great evening and good night.